This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we learn how the 1871 Anti-Klan Act, passed during Reconstruction, is being used in a lawsuit against Donald Trump, Giuliani, the Proud Boys, and the Oath Keepers.
Many historians believe that the Civil War was the second American Revolution. This is a law that came out of the Civil War, and it's applicable today.
We talked to Lynn Ulbricht, mother of the Silk Road website founder Ross Ulbricht, who's serving two life sentences in prison for a nonviolent offense.
Unbelievable. They're putting this man to death on slow death row for what he did on a computer.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Black Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson, with the support of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, last month sued former President Donald Trump, his disgraced lawyer Rudy Giuliani, the fascist group Proud Boys, and the Oath Keepers, a far-right organization of ex-military and policemen. Thompson used the 1871 Anti-Klan Act as a basis for his lawsuit. He alleges that there was a conspiracy between Trump and the other defendants to stop Congress from doing its business when Trump incited the January 6th ransacking of the Capitol. The 1871 Anti-Klan Act was passed for precisely this purpose. 150 years ago, 6 years after the conclusion of the Civil War, the Southern losers, who wanted to keep slavery in another form, formed the Ku Klux Klan to murder, terrorize, and harass black people and prevent them from registering to vote, voting, running for office, or performing their duties after getting elected. The launching of this lawsuit is an extremely positive development. Its chances of success would be increased exponentially if the fight was extended beyond the courtroom and masses of people were mobilized behind it. That's the lesson we learned from Michael Ratner. We speak today with longtime black rights and socialist activist Malik Mia. He's an advisory editor for the Against the Current magazine and a regular contributor to the Australian newspaper Green Left Weekly. Malik Mia is a retired airline mechanic and trade union activist at United Airlines in San Francisco. Malik Mia, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I appreciate being here.
Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson is being supported in his lawsuit against Trump, Giuliani, the Proud Boys, and the Oath Keepers by the NAACP. Please talk a bit about the NAACP, when and who founded it, and for what purpose?
Yes, well, the NAACP is one of the oldest civil rights groups in the United States. It was officially founded in 1909. Though it has roots earlier than that. It was basically a combination of an all-black organization called the Niagara Movement that was formed in the early, about 5 years before that, and progressive whites, mainly pro-abolitionist whites in the North who helped create the NAACP. So when they combined in 1910, when they got the really the name 1910, because that's really when the Niagara Movement, which is the all-black group, came in. That's when it, you know, continued to do its work. And most of its work was around voting rights, and then and that included fighting against, like, lynching, the lynching of African Americans in the country.
Brought under the 1871 Anti-Klan Act, which was passed during Reconstruction, why was the act passed, and why is it applicable today?
Yes, this is an important part of history because after the Civil War, and Reconstruction really began in 1866 after the war ended, but after the Civil War, they passed the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which freed the slaves. But also the 15th Amendment stated very simply that all U.S. citizens had the right to vote, but it did it in a negative way. It said you could not be denied the right to vote because of race, color, or your previous condition, meaning slavery. It left it up to the states, however, to enforce that, which meant that the states could try to get around it. The reason the 1871 Act had to be adopted by the Congress, and that was the Radical Republicans who were the abolitionists, to enforce the 15th Amendment. So they adopted these acts in 1870, 1871, including the Anti-Klan Act, to give legal authority to the Union troops who were in the southern states to allow blacks, former slaves, to gain citizenship rights. So that's why the acts were adopted, because the amendments to the Constitution were not enforceable unless something was done by Congress.
What was Reconstruction?
Well, Reconstruction basically was after the Confederacy was defeated in the Civil War. The question was, how would you grant the former slaves their rights, or should they have rights? Now, the 15th Amendment said they should have citizenship rights, but because of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, which said states implemented basically those rights, the federal government had to find a way to force it through. So Reconstruction was not just amendments, but to get laws. So they occupying troops in the South, the former states, could enforce the Constitution and allow blacks to become a part of American society for the first time ever as potentially equal. I say potentially because that was the goal. Just to give you one important fact, when Reconstruction, which only lasted 10 to 12 years, from 1866 to 1877, there were 16 blacks elected to Congress. There were 3 U.S. senators, and there were probably 600 to 800 people in state legislatures, all in the South. Now that showed you what was the power of what they were doing and the potential of what could have happened in this country.
What was the situation of black people in the South in the years immediately after the Civil War? For example, they voted, they held office. And tell us about why Reconstruction was needed and why it was ended.
Well, it was needed because it was the only way to finally bring black people who were, in the case of the South, were over half the black population, more than half, 80% of the black population lived in the 9 southern states, to give them a chance at real freedom. They never got the land that was talked about. You may have heard of 40 acres in the U. They didn't get that, but they could, if they could get in the state legislatures and pass laws, they could get more rights to own property, do business, be in the schools, and so on. So that's what it meant. Before, you had no rights as a black person. You're basically beholden to the white Confederacy that ran the states. So Reconstruction was, as I like to say, it was the first time in American history we had a chance to build a unified country, a real country that was not based on race, but based on the concept of an idea that everyone who born here were treated equally. The white lost the war, did not agree with that. So that's where we have the problem.
And did black people vote and hold office?
Yes, you could vote, and the vote was based on, male franchise. One of them didn't have the right to vote. So men, once they enforced the 15th Amendment, could vote in the South. So that's why you had that literally biracial legislatures in the South, city councils, and so forth. So you had people could vote to take positions and be responsible citizens in the South.
Why was Reconstruction ended, and who was responsible for killing it?
Okay, so this is an important point, because this is part of the fact that this country never teaches our citizens or anyone about a true American history. Reconstruction, as I said, was a powerful tool to bring equality. The whites who were defeated in the Civil War never liked that. They knew they couldn't go back to slavery because of the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, but they wanted a situation where black people were permanent second-class status. So they opposed it. They set up organizations like the Ku Klux Klan. They used extra legal terror. As long as the troops were there, they could put them out. So they wanted, the only way to get back to the old situation pre-Civil War minus slavery, was to get rid of Reconstruction, get the U.S. troops out of the South. So what happened was, and many of the Republicans who were the radicals in the North, and a lot of white workers included in the North, thought the money was being wasted on this project in the South. So what you had was a situation by 1876 election, the presidential election, where the Democrats and the Republicans were tied in the Electoral College. So it was thrown to Congress. Sounds familiar to today, what they tried to do. So they went to the Congress, and they set up a commission. In the behind closed door, the Democrats and Republicans made a deal that said if the Republicans keep the presidency, this is Hayes, they would he would promise to withdraw the troops from the South. And the Southerners said, if you do that, we'll let you be president, and we will protect the black citizens, which, was, of course, turned out to be a lie. So Hayes carried out withdrawal of the troops in 1877, as far as what they called the compromise, so I call it the Great Compromise. Part of that decision led to the end of Reconstruction, because African-Americans no longer had the protection of the federal government. And so from 1877, you began to see the laws change on voting rights. The Anti-Klan Act technically was formally overturned by the Supreme Court in 1882, but then violence had already been conducted against free blacks. So by the turn of the century, you had no black elected officials, you had no representation, and you could not vote. Because, as I said earlier, the 15th Amendment just said you couldn't deny the right to vote based on your formal condition or your color or creed, but didn't say how you implement it. It was left up to the states. And then the states in the South began to adopt what we later called Jim Crow laws, segregation laws. So some states, like Georgia, said you got to count the number of voting beans or something in a jar if you're black to vote, where whites could be grandfathered in. So all that originated at the end of the 1800s.
There seems to be a lot of interest, Malik Mia, a lot of interest in the Reconstruction period. Last year, for example, PBS had a series produced by Henry Louis Gates, the Harvard professor, on Reconstruction, and a number of books on the topic have come out recently. What accounts for this increase of interest in Reconstruction?
Well, I think there's many reasons, but one of the most important is about the question of the right to vote, enfranchisement. Because the Civil Rights Act, which is 1965, took 90 years after the end of Reconstruction to adopt, has been under severe attack. And the Civil Rights Act basically, in my view, goes back to these 1870 laws. That is, they're trying to say enforce the right to vote. What was it? I can't remember the exact year, when Chief Justice Roberts, 7 or 8 years ago, gutted the Voting Rights Act. Which the heart of the Voting Rights Act was to restrict the ability of states to change their laws to discriminate against minority voters. So that was taken out, which is why you see all these states passing laws against the right to vote. And since the 2020 elections, in the last 2 months, state legislatures, particularly in Republican-controlled states, have proposed over 200 pieces of legislation to restrict the laws even more, voting rights. And today in the Supreme Court, there's a case from Arizona that basically the Republicans say they want to restrict the ability of the state election board to certify election. It's up to the legislature. So a legislature could then just overturn election even if it was approved by the state electors. Now, the Supreme Court is hearing that case right now. It'll be interesting what the result will be. If they vote with Arizona, that's basically the end of the Voting Rights Act, and we're back to where we used to be.
What lessons can we learn from Reconstruction? What did it accomplish?
Well, I think the main lesson, if people will be taught that, that history, is that for that short period of time, you could build a biracial society. You could build a society where blacks and whites could function more or less as equals, being the right to vote, to live in their own homes, to do businesses, and so on. And that proved, those who thought blacks were always inferior, unable to do anything in this country, it disproved it. Now, if people would have taught that true history and may make it easier to make changes today. So I think it's in a very important part of American history, not just Black history, to understand what Reconstruction was and how it was defeated. And it wasn't defeated by some election in truth. It was defeated by the force of white terrorist groups like the Ku Klux Klan, because they didn't wait to change laws in the South. They just start killing people, and then they followed up with new laws, the Jim Crow laws, to enforce it. So you had all the African Americans got elected, basically wiped out. So we learned that. I always say history can be repeated if you don't know it. And I think that's what we have to worry about today.
Congressman Thompson, who is a Black Democrat from Mississippi and who chairs the House Homeland Security Committee, said in a statement when the lawsuit was filed that, quote, "When the majority of Republicans in the Senate abdicated their responsibility to hold the president accountable, we must hold him accountable for the interaction that he so blatantly planned. What has been the activity or lack thereof of the Democratic Party, and particularly the Progressive Caucus of the Democratic Party and the Black Caucus of the Democratic Party, in supporting Congressman Thompson's lawsuit?"
Well, this is a dilemma of the current Black leadership in this country. On the one hand, they know exactly what Congressman Thompson says is true. On the other hand, they would like to operate in the framework of the establishment Democratic Party, which means working with Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, Chuck Schumer in the Senate, and working in the so-called established system of the Congress. So while they may give lip service to what he did, you got to remember, Thompson's suit, he was filed as an individual with the NAACP. It wasn't backed by the Congressional Black Caucus. It wasn't their suit, even though they know it's true. So there's the contradiction. You want to try to operate within the system as it is, but knowing you need to challenge it to its core. And there are very few people in Congress. I don't know of anyone, really. Maybe AOC from New York. But there's very few people who are ready to take on and smash the call for the total dismantlement of the system we have. So that's why I don't see the Congress. I mean, they would support it if it goes forward. They don't believe it probably will, because if the Supreme Court especially rules on like this Arizona case and some of these other cases in a negative way, there's no way this lawsuit will advance very far. And remember, the NAACP never filed a suit like this before until this recent, after the November 3rd election. This is when they decided to try to stop it. They never did it in the 1900s. So it tells you something about what they thought was.
Well, what is the NAACP's use of the 1871 Anti-Klan Act show us about the impact of the Black Lives Matter struggle?
Well, I think that's a very good question, because I believe the heart of all what's taking place is the power of the Black Lives Matter movement last year. That is, everyone began to see that the way you force legislators or the politicians and the establishment to do anything is by mass street protests. And the Black Lives Matter movement, it didn't just happen in big urban centers in the North. It happened in all 50 states. It happened in small communities that actually were mostly all white, because they could see the injustice of what the police did to George Floyd and other people. So I think the power of that movement, which still exists, is putting pressure on all the politicians and the civil rights groups like the NAACP. So they recognize that movement is still strong. You don't hear as much about it except the attacks by Republicans. But as someone who's a member or a supporter and follower of all the groups, because the Black Lives Matter movement is not one organization, there's multiple groups and activities. They're all continuing to organize, all continue to do protests. So that's real pressure. That's real pressure. So I think you wouldn't have seen the NAACP act this way if it wasn't for the existence of that movement.
Why is the Biden administration and Joe Biden himself standing quiet in fighting Trumpism?
I think the Democratic Party establishment hopes we could go back to the pre-Trump era, which was not a good era in truth. But they believe there's a way to get what they call moderate Republicans to work with them. The fact that the stimulus bill they're talking about, They can't get one Republican to support it, to tell them something. But Biden has this grand strategy that, which is not a new strategy for the Democrats in the last 50 years, that to work with Republicans, even though at the end, as Obama showed, they won't vote for anything that's done. So if you water down your bills and make changes, it won't happen. And I think that's the strategy of Biden and the Democrats. It will not work because the right, and the far right, which controls the party, Trump controls the Republican Party, does not bid. They still tell the big lie about he won the election. He said it was this past weekend. He said, I won the election, and I guess I have to win the third election in 2024. So they all believe that. So the people who follow Trump and Trumpism cannot be defeated by pretending that it could just fade away, which I think is the problem with Biden and the whole Democratic Party establishment.
Malik, what we saw on January 6th was, in my opinion, a manifestation of an American form of fascism. The mob that ransacked the Capitol came from a strata of society that historically has been the core of fascist movements. Germany is the prime example. That mob was not mainly workers, but by and large, they were lower middle class and middle class people. They were all white. They were small businessmen, accountants, middle-level managers, even some doctors and lawyers. They were people that had money troubles. They had gone bankrupt, couldn't pay their bills, owed taxes. What are your thoughts about that movement that ransacked the Capitol?
Yes, well, I definitely agree with you that it was not just simply a pro-Trump movement that had no social roots in society, mainly in the white community. There were very few workers from unions or other places there. I'm sure they were there. They were mainly, as you call them, lower middle class or even middle class. There were a lot of police there out of uniform. And as anyone knows American history, the police are always rifled with right-wing elements. To support it. There were military people there. So yes, my view, which was not my view even 6 months ago, that the Trump movement is based on these extra-legal groups like the Proud Boys, Three Percenters, and others, and it is the basis of a new American-type fascist movement. And it's not going away. And you cannot just defeat it by passing some laws or, like I'll just add as a side point, or trying to ban Trump and others off Facebook and Twitter. I think that's a mistake, because I don't think any laws to ban anyone off these media will go after the left and go after the Black Lives Matter movement. It's better to fight them on the ideas and fight them with counter-protests and demonstrations. But yes, I think we have a new neo-American fascist-type movement that exists. It cannot be defeated by laws. And the laws will come later if you actually defeat them on the street. So that's my basic analysis of what January 6th. And the fact that everyone's retreating on it, on the Republican side, who criticized it already, shows that Trumpism is stronger than it was even before the last election.
Do you think the Democratic Party is a blunt instrument in fighting fascism? After all, they won't mobilize the population against it. They will not support a massive social democratic program to address the economic disaster we're in, and they can't even pass a $15 an hour minimum wage law, or provide health care for everyone, or cancel student debt. Do we need our own party? And if so, how can we get that?
Yes, the Democratic Party is worse than a blunt instrument because it builds illusions that that's the road to solving the problems. Not just the problem of Trumpism, but the problems of health care, wages, benefits, and so on. And, of course, racial injustice. So it's worse than just if they didn't pretend. People now, a lot of people are hoping that Biden and the Democrats will do it. It will never happen. Again, study history. It will never happen. Even the old radical Republicans after the Civil War retreated. So we do need a new party, a working-class type party, or just a mass third party. My personal view, and I've had this view for the last probably 20 years, we need to tear up the current Constitution and have a constituent assembly, new Constitution written by the people in a fair democratic process. Because the original Constitution was not only written with the mindset of landowners who were white men, but it was also written to appease the slaveholders. And that's never changed. That's why the Senate is not democratic. The Senate does not represent the majority of people. Even the way the gerrymandering goes on in states. So if you really rewrote the Constitution and made it more democratic, that would be better. I know many people fear that because they think the right would run it. You could never get a constituent assembly unless there was a mass revolutionary struggle in this country. They say we need a new Constitution. The idea that you can tinker with this current Constitution to get equality, I think, is a mistake, which is what the Democratic Party believes. I don't think most people on the left, far left, think that, including in the black community, but they don't see an alternative, so they support Democrats for the most part. But, even a parliamentary system would be better than what we have now.
Well, Malik Mia, with that insight, I'm sorry that we're running out of our allotted time, but we're going to have to say goodbye to you. But before we end the interview, can you tell us how people can follow your work?
Yes. Well, I do a regular race and class column for the magazine Against the Current, which is published in Detroit. It's at againstthecurrent.org. And then I also write for an international newspaper, the Green Left Weekly in Australia, which is the most widely circulated socialist paper in Australia. And that address is greenleft.org.au. I probably write two to three articles a month in that publication. And my articles are picked up in other publications, but those are my two primary sites.
Malik Mia, thank you very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Seven years ago, a New York jury found Ross Ulbricht guilty on charges related to operating the Silk Road website. The site was a Tor hidden site and used Bitcoin, triggering an all-out FBI search to determine the operator's identity. The 29-year-old was convicted on 7 charges, including a kingpin charge, and Judge Catherine Forrest imposed 2 life sentences plus 40 years without possibility of parole for the young, nonviolent, first-time offender. The sentence was far longer than prosecutors sought. The website sold, among other items, illicit substances. Ross was not convicted of selling illegal drugs, but rather of creating an e-commerce website that others elected to use for that purpose. At trial, no victims were named. Rather, rampant corruption, abuse, evidence tampering, and several violations of Ross's constitutional rights cast doubt among the legal and tech communities of both the conviction and its extraordinary sentence. In the 2016 appeal, defense attorneys presented a litany of improprieties in the investigation and in the trial itself. One of the most consequential of these was the court precluding information about 2 corrupt federal agents investigating the Silk Road who were sent to prison on corruption charges. The Supreme Court refused to consider the case. So supporters have spent the last 4 years preparing to petition Donald Trump for clemency. Joining us to talk about that initiative and to give us an update on Ross is his mother, Lynn Ulbricht. Lynn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
Lynn, for listeners who may not be familiar with Ross's case, can you give us a nutshell overview?
Sure. Ross, my son, was very idealistic, libertarian, who was really on fire for free markets. He was very excited about that, and he wanted to introduce an experience of that to people. And he started out with a video game that would do that, and he almost got it published. But when that didn't work, he turned to the internet and created a site called Silk Road, which was... And this is when he was 26 years old. And this was kind of like an eBay, but it was on, you had to use Tor. It was on the dark net, meaning you had to use Tor. You couldn't just go on regular internet. And you had to use Bitcoin. So you had to open a Bitcoin account and fund it and all of that to use it. So it's pretty obscure. But pretty much the whole thing was to allow people to exchange what they wanted as long as it didn't hurt a third party. It was strictly based on the non-aggression principle and voluntary interaction, no force. So if 2 people wanted to exchange something and it didn't hurt another person, it was permitted. If it did, it was prohibited. So, for example, there was no child pornography permitted because that hurts a child. Or stolen property was prohibited because it hurts the owner of the property, that kind of thinking. And so it was an idealistic venture. But unfortunately, a lot of people took advantage of the anonymity, because it was relatively anonymous, to exchange drugs. At the time, marijuana, mostly marijuana, was a user amount of marijuana was what was exchanged. And at the time, marijuana was, I think, almost all across the United States illegal. But of course, times have changed. And, you know, people know all about Bitcoin now. It's not considered a big threat. Marijuana is legal in many states, but at the time it was not. So that was very alarming to the authorities, and Ross was arrested and brought to trial, and the judge Catherine Forrest, ultimately gave him double life plus 40 years for this website. And it was all nonviolent charges. There was no violence in his charges at all.
As a nonviolent criminal offender, you also tried bringing his case before the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Well, first we went to the appellate court, and they denied our appeal. And then we went to the Supreme Court. And at that point, the Supreme Court only deals with overarching issues, not particulars of a trial. And by the way, the trial was quite the travesty, but I, you know, that's a whole other conversation we can have. But the Supreme Court turned him down as well on 2 issues that I think are very important, and I'm sorry they did for a lot of reasons. One is that the government can go into any of our internet activity and use it against us without a warrant, without probable cause, in secret, and they upheld that. And the other was that a judge can use unproven, uncharged allegations to enhance a sentence and put somebody away for life, which is what this judge did. This is a violation of the Sixth Amendment. You're supposed to be able to defend yourself against your accusers and be judged by a jury of your peers, not one judge. So the Supreme Court turned that down, which is to the detriment of our country. And so then we went into the political realm of trying to get clemency from the president.
Before we talk about the clemency effort, I know you worked on that for 4 years. Tell us a bit about what you just mentioned, bringing up uncharged offenses during sentencing. What was that about?
Right. Well, the prosecution alleged that Ross had planned murder for hire. And actually, they first brought it up, which we had no idea this was coming, at the bail hearing. And I just recently discovered that they submitted evidence that they had tampered with. It was a chat, anonymous chat, and originally that chat was written by a handle. One of the people, the handle was Myself. That was what they called themselves, Myself. And by the time it got into the court, they had substituted Ross's name. And Myself had said something about planning murder for hire. So this isn't, you know, they just put Ross's name in there and handed it to the court. So this is the kind of activity that we've been dealing with all along. And it's really outrageous.
Lynn, who is Curtis Green and how was he involved in that?
Curtis was a top-level administrator in Silk Road. And he was arrested by the agents. Well, we had to retread because the agents who arrested him have been since arrested themselves and put into prison for corruption. So, but those same agents used him to supposedly set up DPR, whoever that was, to agree to murder for hire. And Curtis himself has come out in defense of Ross. He doesn't believe Ross was the person who did that, and he's publicly supporting Ross. So, but that's who he is.
And you referenced DPR for Dread Pirate Roberts, which, as listeners may or may not know, was the moniker for the site operators, plural.
Well, it's supposedly one. I mean, that's what the government said, but there's a lot of evidence, both anecdotal and official, that indicate that there were at least one other one, but probably many others.
And didn't something happen after Ross was in prison where DPR posted?
Absolutely. The defense team continued to research and dig into the evidence. I mean, what happens with, very typically, is the government dumps so much evidence on you to go through looking for needles in the haystack that you don't find everything. And so this wasn't found until after trial. But what was proven was that, quote-unquote, DPR logged in to the Silk Road Forum after Ross was already in prison. So obviously someone had access to that account.
During Ross's trial, I so vividly recall how tech experts, libertarians, people familiar with cryptocurrency, which, as you mentioned, was relatively new back then compared to now, were closely watching the case for the reasons you mentioned, the impact that this would have on individuals' privacy all across the nation. Why do you think some politicians and others in leadership positions showed such vitriol to the case? Was it because of the dark web and anonymity?
Well, I think there's a good case for that, and you're really an expert on that. I also think a related thing is Bitcoin itself, which is part of that whole, you know, anonymity. And it was a very new upstart financial system. And I think the reason I think it was Bitcoin is the drug offenders involved in Silk Road, the biggest drug seller in Silk Road got 10 years. He's already out. He got actually only served 7 years. Ross was never accused of selling drugs himself at all. It's just having a platform where other people did. It's kind of like throwing Zuckerberg in prison because of all the drugs that are sold on Facebook, which is a lot, much more than Silk Road ever did.
That's interesting. I never knew that. Naive me.
That even came before Congress, that they started tracking it, and it was dwarfed Silk Road in like 6 months. But, yeah, oh, there's all kinds of, I've been told, Craigslist, all of these sites, they're all trading drugs, and so, yeah.
Perhaps the success, and even Ross has said the success of the Silk Road took off beyond his wildest dreams. I would imagine it was getting media attention. It was a really creative idea, and that probably angered the powers that be. I wanted to mention that Ross is a scientist. His undergraduate and graduate degrees were in science, weren't they?
Yeah, he's not a programmer. He's not a computer programmer. There's no way that he could have run this whole thing from a cafe on his laptop. I mean, it's absurd. I just want to make one other point about the Bitcoin, because it came out through Snowden that a couple of months before Silk Road was taken down, the NSA was urgently tracking Bitcoin users. They were, which I think they're supposed to just track terrorists, not American citizens, but I think there were a lot of American citizens in that their sites. But in any case, it was very, very concerning to them about Bitcoin. I thought, you know, just to answer that.
Let's fast forward a bit. Over the past 4 years, during the Trump administration, you and others have worked feverishly to put Ross's case in the consciousness of Donald Trump and some of his colleagues. Tell us what it was like to work for 4 years on trying to get clemency for Ross.
Yeah, well, I had to shift gears from the courts to politics. And in some ways, it was more natural for me because dealing with the courts and the law, as you well know, is, you know, it's challenging. And a lot of it doesn't make any sense to me personally. But anyway, where you get into politics, it's just really people and who you know or can get to know. And so that was, you know, we worked very, very hard. We got, you know, hundreds of letters to the president in a packet. You wrote one of them. We prepared a huge presentation to him, probably bigger than anyone else did, and just began to accrue support. And it's really one person leads to another. And so really, at this point, I'd like to say to your listeners, if anyone, because we have to shift to a new administration, if anyone has connections with the Democrats, please let me know. I'm just doing the same thing as before, because it worked. What happened was we actually did get into the Oval Office. Trump knew who Ross was. He told one person who talked to him about Ross, he said, I have never had so many people come to me about someone as Ross. And he agreed that the sentence was terrible, and he was very open to it and really wanted to do it. And his opposition, and that was after, you know, years of our working to get his attention and all of that through COVID and the election and all these chaos after the election and all that, trying to get through. And we did it. And Ross was approved with many others on a list. Actually, it was on one list and taken off, and then everybody was, and he only did Flynn, General Flynn. He was on that original list, but that was removed. And I think it's because of the DOJ fighting Ross being on there. And then he was on another list, and we were so hopeful that he was being opposed for a long time by the White House counsel. And Trump even said that. He said, they're fighting me on this. Now, he can override them, but anyway, he was being opposed by the White House counsel and the lead counsel, Pat Cipollone, who just was totally against Roth having clemency, and I think others. I don't think they wanted him to do any clemency, or as little as possible. And so, at the end, Roth was on the list. A bunch of people, probably 60 to 100 people, were just on the list. And what the White House counsel's office was doing was dragging their feet and running out the clock. And it was so frustrating. We're like, so is the paperwork done? You know, it's like waiting for bureaucrats to do anything. And they just dragged their feet and dragged their feet. But I just wanted to, the last thing I just wanted to say is that really, potentially 100 people are still in cages because of late paperwork. And this is, to me, terrible. It's like, it shouldn't take paperwork for the president to pardon someone, but apparently that's the way it goes. And so all these people are still in prison for who knows how long because the White House counsel's office, being pushed by the DOJ, I believe, because they brought in a bunch of DOJ attorneys for some reason, were purposely stalling. That's what I've been told. I've been told it by more people on the inside who are dealing with it and trying to make it not happen.
You know, Lynn, on the last couple of days of the Trump administration, I couldn't stop thinking about Ross waiting, his spirits, you know, lifted over the last couple of years with the prospect of release. How is Ross now?
Yeah, it was rough because Ross got word from a guard that he was not on that final list, and he couldn't call or anything, and we couldn't call him. So he's just sitting there in a metal box that he'd been in since March with that news. And, you know, but typical Ross, when he wrote me, all he cared about was me. Like, he didn't want me to be in pain. He was so sorry for me.
Yeah,
he's just one of the most, I don't know, unselfish people. And just, yeah. So, yeah, it's been, you know, it's been horrible. He saw all these hopes and dreams go down the toilet, for now anyway. But at the same time, Ross is quite amazing. You know him. You've met him. He's, you know, trying to keep his spirits up. He meditates. He prays. He reads. He's just making the best of the situation. And that's Ross. And, of course, we're doing what we can. We've got to start from scratch now with a new administration. I hope that the new administration will be very pro-clemency. I don't know. I've heard different mixed things. Hopefully we'll not just turn it over to the DOJ because, as far as I can tell, they don't want anybody out of prison. I mean, I don't know why they were so against Ross. I don't know if there's something that I don't know about or whether it's just that he was a trophy and they don't want to lose their trophy. I don't know.
Lynn, I think it was because he was a trophy. He was creative. And therefore, with his highly successful endeavor, it put to shame, I guess, the law enforcement agencies that were trying to find out his identity over that, you know, couple of years, period of time. And whenever activists, and we probably didn't think of Ross as an activist years back, but he's now a symbol to so many. He cared about freedom and liberty. And now he's really a symbol of that for so many people around the globe. You know that so well. So it's imperative that we work just as hard to get him out during this administration. How can our listeners get involved in this effort?
Well, really what I need most is what I had before and started again from scratch, is connections. Anyone who has any connections with the Democrats in any way, because one person leads to another, please let me know. You can go to freeross.org. At the bottom of every page is a footer with a way to get a hold of me. It's very easy to get a hold of me through that site. We need connections. We need people who care enough. And I'm hoping that a lot of the people on the left who did work hard for criminal justice reform, and I assume will be working hard again, continuing to, will, be helpful. Ross is like the poster child for excessive sentencing. His sentence sets a precedent, a terrible precedent, for a really outrageous sentence. I mean, this is a death sentence. This is a death in prison sentence. This is not a life sentence. It's a death sentence. And it just is. You spend the rest of your life in that confinement. He was young when he went into prison. He was 29. He's now about to be 37. He's not going to do it again. I mean, that's absurd. And they were all nonviolent charges for a first-time offender. This is a very bad thing to happen in our system, not just to him, but for many others. It really needs to be corrected.
Yes, and I think hopefully with the movement toward criminal justice reform, Ross, as you said, stood out with Donald Trump, and we can make him stand out to the Biden administration. And I believe, Lynn, that you can garner as much, if not more, support in the coming couple of years. We've got to get Ross out.
I just hope that they have a separate clemency, board or committee or something separate from the DOJ, because there has to be a balance there. Yeah. The Department of Justice is not interested in getting people out of prison.
Lynn, we've unfortunately run out of time. Keep up the phenomenal work that you and your team have been doing. And we want to stay in touch, of course. But best to Ross, and have a great day.
Yeah, you too, Heidi. Thanks for everything you've done.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.